Today is February 15th, 2019. Happy Valentine's, post-Valentine's Day to everybody. I am Kyra Mann, CEO of Mito Action, and I'd like to welcome everyone to today's call. We're excited to have Ted Chufas and Saad Dino, both from Acton Pharmacy, with us today to talk about the Mito Cocktail and answer all of your questions A to Z about the Mito Cocktail. Just a few housekeeping items before we get started. The line is going to be muted, so you will not be able to ask questions live. And I would, we really want everyone to participate and get a chance to ask questions. So if you do have questions as the presentation is going on, you can email them to us at info@mitoaction.org, and we will facilitate those questions at the end of today's call. The slides for today's call are up and available on our website if you don't already have them. They are available at www.mitoaction.org/mitococktail2019. And there you'll see the details for today's call. And on the right-hand side, there is an option, Select View Slides, and you can follow along with today's presentation. Today's call is being recorded, and we encourage you to visit our website to re-listen to the information, as well as sharing today's great information with your family, caregivers, your medical team, or anyone that you think will benefit from today's call. To access the recording, you can go to the exact same URL, mitoaction.org/mitococktail2019, and by the end of the day today, the recording will be available there for you to share and listen to. As I said again, if you have any questions, please feel free to email those to us throughout today's presentation to info@mitoaction.org. Okay, so let's get started. As I said, my name is Kyra Mann. I'm the CEO of Mito Action, and I am honored to be here with you today to bring what we hope will be great information that will benefit each of you on your journey with Mito. Today's speaker, Ted Chufas, is a clinical pharmacist in charge of the compounding lab at Acton Pharmacy. He's an adjunct assistant professor and graduate from Worcester Polytech Institute with a degree in biochemistry. In 2011, he earned his pharmacy doctorate from Mass College of Pharmacy in Boston. He has worked in the compounding lab at Acton Pharmacy since 2005 as a technician, intern, and pharmacist. Over the years, he has built close relationships with his patients and providers, working closely with them to develop dosage forms that meet individualized needs. He has worked with mitochondrial providers and patients, trying to match the best formulation for taste and dosage for ease of use. In addition, he has developed formulations, training for staff, and protocols for the lab. While he has been at Acton, the lab has received accreditation by the Pharmacy Compounding Accreditation Board, UCAP, and high marks from a National Association of Boards of Pharmacy Inspection. He continues to strive for improvement through training and education, both in pharmacy compounding and regulation. We also have on the line Saad Dino, who is the owner of Acton Pharmacy. Saad has given lectures on mitochondrial disease across the country, as well in Australia. His staff works with patients and their providers on insurance coverage issues, compliance, taste, dosage form, counseling on the medications being dispensed, and other relevant mito information and general questions. Saad is a member of the Massachusetts Independent Pharmacy Association, Massachusetts Pharmacists Association, National Community Pharmacists Association, and International Academy of Compounding Pharmacists. He is a past president of the Massachusetts Independent Pharmacy Association and previously served on the Professional Compounding Centers of America Advisory Board. Saad has received numerous awards, including being named the Margaret Bowman Outstanding Medical Professor for his work serving the autism community. So please join me in welcoming Saad and Ted.
Thank you so much for having us. We totally appreciate what Mito Action does on behalf of all those that have mitochondrial disease. I'm going to pass on the mic to Ted and have him discuss with you guys the mitochondrial cocktail and how we became involved in it and all that good stuff. He's a great professor. So,
You guys will be learning a lot from him. So, and I'll be on the phone, obviously, listening in. So thank you so much for having us. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Saad.
Thanks, Saad. Thanks, Kyra, for having us. So we'll get a little bit started. I want to do a little bit of background information on mitochondria and then kind of dive into the supplementation and different possibilities with what exists for supplementations for mitochondrial disease. So a little bit about mitochondria. They're basically the powerhouse of the cell. They develop and create almost all the energy that is utilized by the body. They're found in every single cell of the body. They create energy based on molecules that come in from the different cycles, like the Krebs cycle or citric acid cycle, and they produce most of the energy that is used in tissues such as the muscle, brain, kidneys, liver, etc. They are very unique parts of a cell. They are more like bacteria than they are a normal organelle of the cell. If we go to slide 4, you can see how the cell structure is kind of laid out with all the different organelles, and the mitochondria is a little kidney-shaped or oblong-shaped organelle that has little folds inside of it. So it has its own DNA, unlike anything else in the cell other than the nucleus. And when the cell divides, the mitochondria divide on their own. So if a cell has damaged mitochondria, then you're going to have damaged mitochondrial replication. During the process of energy creation, we're going to see that there's ways that cells get, or mitochondria get damaged, and even cellular material can get damaged. And that's what supplementation kind of targets to help with. The fact that they have their own DNA and it's very similar to bacteria means that they don't have quite the same mechanisms that a normal human cell or just the overall cell is going to have for protecting its code to make sure it replicates appropriately and not have any translation or transcription errors when regenerating itself or when it's dividing. It also means that a lot of things that will affect bacteria, so some antibiotics, some metabolic drugs, will affect the mitochondria as well. And we'll see that a little bit later as well. The interesting thing is that nearly all of the mitochondria are inherited solely from the mother. There's been some debate over the past few years about this, that some of the sperm mitochondria may actually make it into the cell and divide, but there's never been any definitive evidence for that, and it seems that it's nearly 100% of the mitochondria come from the ovum or from the mom. The damage to mitochondria can't be reversed. We can't re-engineer or make the mitochondria's DNA be normal again. What we can do is try and prevent any further damage or any more problems that are happening or maybe that will potentiate down the line. And because this damage is genetic, it can be inherited from mother to child and so forth. We all get damage to our mitochondria. It's not just patients who have mitochondrial disease have damage to their mitochondria. I don't care if you're Tom Brady eating 1,000 avocados a day. you're still going to get damage to the mitochondria. You're still going to age. That's the normal aging process. And you can almost think of damaged mitochondria as in a patient to be almost an older mitochondria, if you will. It's lived quickly, and even though it's only a few years old, or you know however old the person may be, it's almost like it's acting like it's you know 20, 30 years older. It's a very general a concept of it, but it might help you think of how damage happens to mitochondria over time. The Krebs cycle that we spoke about earlier, basically it's the quickest way that ATP, or the energy for the cell, is created by one glucose molecule being broken down into two pyruvic acids, and those enter the cycle. As you can see, there's NADH being created, ADP being created, and the NADH is used later on in the mitochondria for energy production. So it's a very critical part of energy production, and some supplementation does go into citric acid being a supplement, pyruvic acid for some patients, acetyl-CoA. Whether those supplements are useful or not is up for debate, but the whole point of it is to try and target maybe mutations in the cellular DNA, because this doesn't happen in the mitochondria. There are some cellular DNA issues that may prevent some of these enzymes that break down the processes or function in this Krebs cycle. If they're not functioning quite as well, if they can't create, for example, citric acid in the cycle, then perhaps we supplement with citric acid and you bypass that. So you basically are almost like jump-starting the engine, if you will. This is the electron transport chain on slide 7. It's where you see the little stars is what we're going to be talking about with the damage. So it's a very complicated process. I'm not going to go into it because it's a lot of biochemistry involved. But NADH is used, that we saw from the previous slide in the Krebs cycle, is used here to create the ATP. But the stars are where the damage occurs when there's oxidation or reduction happening of certain molecules, which leads to what are called free radicals. If we jump real quickly to slide 9, you'll see oxygen and then a pathway of oxygen there are free radicals being generated from oxygen, which are called reactive oxygen species. And those are what interact with different parts of the cellular material, whether they're in the mitochondria or just in the general cell as well. They can interact with the lipids on the membrane. That can make the cell be unstable and burst and die. It can interact with DNA, creating mutations in the DNA that the cell cannot replicate appropriately, and that creates issues either in the daughter cells that are created, or it just won't replicate, or it may, again, die. It can create problems with proteins, and proteins are the main building blocks, or the main workers of the building blocks of a cell. So they're the enzymes that create energy. They create the lipids or other proteins in normal cellular functions. So with that damage happening, and these are ineffective proteins, then functions in the cell are ineffective. The cell may survive, it may even replicate, but it won't replicate very well. If we go back to slide 8, you can see that each complex that is there has CoQ10 reductase or CoQ10 in this title. So we know right off the bat that CoQ10 or coenzyme Q10 plays a big role in the electron transport chain and the creation of energy. It's going to be one of the main supplements we're going to be talking about. Mitochondrial location, like we said, is everywhere. The fact that the tissues that we see that are most affected, the brain, the skeletal muscle, heart, kidney, liver, is because they're very mitochondrial rich. And with the damage that happens to those organs, you end up having neuromuscular disorders, cognitive impairment. You can have metabolic issues with the liver and the kidney. So that's why it's important that we understand like the basics of how we're affecting everything. So moving on to the therapies, most what we're going to talk about is a supplementation and diet and lifestyle and nutrition. There are other therapies for patients with doctors, exercise, physical therapy, speech and cognitive therapies. There are surgeries available for organ failures or for tissue systems, assistive devices like hearing aids, et cetera. But what we're going to look at is mostly the supplementation and the diet and lifestyle. So it's a combination of different vitamins, cofactors, and antioxidants. What we spoke about with the reactive oxygen species is we're trying to quench them as much as possible. If they're reactive, they're a problem. So how do we get them to be unreactive? You basically use a scavenging molecule to help absorb the free radicals. That way they can't have an impact on cellular functions. If it attacks something that we supplement with instead of your DNA or your cellular functions, you know, that's great because now that thing that you supplemented with is taken out, but the cell still remains functional. Formulas that are developed for patients by doctors are very patient-specific. They're based on tissue cultures, blood work, DNA testing. They're not generic to everybody. While a doctor may start a patient on a similar therapy to another patient over time and with additional blood work and lab information, we're going to see different supplementation, different doses for individual patients. you know, we've had situations where we have twins, and even though the twins are genetically identical, they have two different mitochondrial cocktails. Most of the information that we're going to go over is anecdotal because there's not enough clinical trials or clinical information on supplementation in mitochondrial disease. I know MitoAction has been working with a lot of doctors and a lot of different organizations and groups to develop better guidelines, to develop better clinical trials, et cetera. So we're improving. We have more and more information than we did 2 years ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago. The primary piece of literature that acted as a guide was Dr. Parikh's Modern Approach to the Treatment of Mitochondrial Disease, which I believe is still available on the MitoAction website from several years ago. And that was the precursor for, like, or not the precursor, but the first ever, like, statement about what can be utilized in mitochondrial disorders. He published another paper recently in 2015, called The Diagnosis and Management of Mitochondrial Disease, a consensus statement from the Mitochondrial Medicine Society. Kyra, I'm not sure is that posted on MitoAction or not?
It is. Yes,
the consensus
statement is available on our site.
Okay, perfect. So that's available there. I'm sorry, I couldn't find it when I wrote up the slide, so I apologize for not including it, but it's on there. And that's given us a lot more information because what the Mitochondrial Medicine Society did was gather a lot of information from their patients and their doctors and find out what good courses were and look at all the literature reviews and figure out what should be offered, what can be utilized for patients, and some things that they said should not be utilized. So it was like the first ever consensus statement, if you will. They hesitated to call it that in the article, but there were areas where they called it consensus statements. But they were published for the first time in mitochondrial disease. CoQ10, which is the first supplement, and probably the most important supplement we'll talk about. It's normally created in all mammalian mitochondria. You, me, dogs, cats, everybody, we have CoQ10 in our system. It is critical for our functionality, as you saw from the electron transport chain. It's used right there, just in energy creation. It's synthesized by the liver, and it makes its way into every single cell in the body and eventually to its functions in the cell. It's found in the cell and organelle membranes, which means that the cell's ability to bring in and put out different, you know, chemicals, signals, markers, et cetera, is reliant on CoQ10. Without it, the fluidity of the membrane would be stiffer. The cells may not be able to bring in or take out either, you know, medication, toxins, cellular signals, et cetera, and that can lead to problems in cellular function. It's involved in programmed cell death. I know that sounds a little bit strange or weird, but when a cell gets to a certain point and gets damaged, you kind of want it to die. It's one of the reasons that, or one of the mechanisms we have for cancer management in our bodies, is when a cell starts acting funny, there are different mechanisms that will, you know, kill it, basically. If CoQ10 is absent, sometimes the cell death isn't going to happen, and a bad cell may replicate. If it replicates enough in an area, it can either cause damage to the tissue or it can be precancerous or cancerous. The CoQ10 itself is very insoluble in water. It's a very fatty liquid or fatty molecule. It has a good dilution in fat, so that's why it sits in the lipid membranes. It sits in the organelle membranes, electron transport chain, because it doesn't sit in a water suspension very well. It does have improved bioavailability if you're taking nanoparticles in suspension, and it's one of the only treatments that has been documented and FDA approved for mitochondrial disease. There are three different forms of CoQ10. There's ubiquinone, ubiquinol, and idebenone. So we'll talk about each one of those. The differences are slight structure modifications, meaning it's some are smaller, some are larger. Ubiquinol has been made to be more water soluble, about 10% more water soluble than ubiquinol, or ubiquinol is 10% more soluble than ubiquinone. When you're looking at the different availabilities, so ubiquinol exists as a powder and as a liquid. The ubiquinol powder only has about 30% active drug because it's hard to get more of that in there and able to have the drug solubilize when it's being worked on. And the ubiquinol liquids that are available are usually lower concentrations because, again, the same problem. You have a harder time, even while you're solubilizing it, you have to keep it stable. It's sold as capsules, liquids. It's available over the counter. And there's been some small studies, about 10 to 15 people, generally healthy adults, that were given ubiquinone daily for 4 weeks. Then they were washed out for 4 weeks, meaning for 4 weeks they took nothing and allowed their CoQ10 levels to normalize in their tissue and their plasma. Then they were given ubiquinol for 4 weeks. And what was measured was the ubiquinol and ubiquinone availability in the blood. They did show that there was about 1.5 times more ubiquinol when the patient was being supplemented with ubiquinol versus ubiquinone. But the markers of oxidative stress were not altered in these patients. So even though they had more CoQ10 available, it didn't have any benefit from the oxidative stress, which is what we're looking at, the reactive oxygen species and the damage, than from one versus the other. Ubiquinol exists in the body with ubiquinone. So we don't make purely ubiquinone. We make one type. And nobody's able to, again, define it, whether it's ubiquinone or ubiquinol, because it exists at a 50-50 ratio at any given point, which is called homeostasis. What happens is, in suspension, ubiquinone and ubiquinol keep switching back and forth between their two isoforms. They are very similar in structure, very similar in nature. They just don't, they can't exist only as one or the other, because in water solution, it keeps reverting back and forth. And when it's transported in the blood cell and the mitochondria, it keeps changing between these configurations. It's never stable in just one configuration in one place. There are a few different considerations to take into account regarding these different molecules. Ubiquinone is cheaper, so from a cost perspective, ubiquinone would probably be the better choice from, at that point. There's the bulkiness or stability consideration, where there's no real evidence that one is going to work better than the other. Ubiquinol, you have to take sometimes, the doses are less, but you have to take more volume of something in order to get the same ubiquinone dose, just because, again, that solubility and response. Some patients swear that if they take ubiquinol, they feel 1,000 times better, and that's great. And if that's the situation, continue taking ubiquinol. There's no one right answer or one right benefit from one over the other. In the consensus statements, Dr. Parikh and everybody else spoke about in their publication was that CoQ10 should be offered to most patients with mitochondrial disease. So it is something that is being utilized a lot in mitochondrial disease. Excess amounts of CoQ10 do get stored in the body. So if you take more than your normal dose, it will stay in the fat deposits. It is something that you need to consider because it can have pro-oxidation effects. So what you're trying to prevent, it sometimes can cause damage, which is why you need a prescriber to be with you and telling you which doses to take, because if you take too high of a dose, too much of a good thing can be a bad thing. The next supplement we're going to talk about is riboflavin, or vitamin B2. It's a very like CoQ10, it's a very orange molecule, but it's even more bright orange. When you take high doses of B2, you excrete it in your urine, which can turn your urine very, very bright orange, or like almost like a neon color. It's not harmful at larger doses. You just excrete it. You don't utilize it after a certain point. It is critical in certain protein precursors, like flavoproteins, which are critical in the breakdown of sugars into the Krebs cycle, as well as other proteins that are found in the Krebs cycle in complex 1 and 2. There is a version of a metabolic deficiency called multiple acyl-CoA dehydrogenase deficiency, or MAD. There's an inability to incorporate vitamin B2 into certain proteins and enzymatic reactions. So the only way to do that is to over-supplement, and that way it'll kind of force that incorporation. You need flavor proteins for removal of radicals that contribute to oxidative stress, DNA repair, as well as that cellular mechanism we spoke about, the programmed cell death. The consensus statement that was published spoke about riboflavin being offered to patients with mitochondrial disorders. Levocarnitine is responsible for the generation or the breakdown of fatty acids and the generation of acyl-CoA, which acyl-CoA or acetyl-CoA is critical first step in the Krebs cycle. So it's one way that that you can get fatty acids to be broken down into energy and not just be around, not be utilized. Without levocarnitine, you can't utilize it. Everybody has some levocarnitine in their body. If you eat meat, you get levocarnitine in your diet. There's no definitive lack of carnitine in mitochondrial disease. The addition of carnitine in mitochondrial disease increases the amount of free carnitine, which theoretically helps you utilize fatty acids better, but there's no definitive proof of that. The consensus statement stated that levocarnitine should be administered to mitochondrial disease patients where there is a documented deficiency of levocarnitine. Doses used to be really, really high of levocarnitine, but they've recommended much lower doses because you don't need quite as high for the supplementation to get that oversaturation of levocarnitine. Too much levocarnitine can actually cause buildup in the kidneys, possibly some kidney damage, and it can cause seizures. The next slide, in slide 19, is more of a diagram of levocarnitine's role. So we're going to ignore that because we're not really worried about that pathway. Leucovorin or folinic acid comes in different forms, folic acid, folinic acid, L-methylfolate. They all enter the fatty, the folic acid synthase reactions at different steps, depending on what step they're in and what the supplement is. If you have methylation issues, which some patients do, then you're going to need to do something like L-methylfolate. Otherwise, you're not going to get, you're not going to be able to utilize your folic acid. The consensus statement with folic acid is this should be considered in patients who have central nervous system manifestations of mitochondrial disease and those with documented cerebral spinal fluid deficiency or disease states known to be associated with the deficiency, like Kern-Sarnes syndrome has a cerebral folate deficiency. Arginine is an amino acid. Again, it's found in diet mostly. You do need an oversupplementation of this if you have situations where you have MELAS or stroke-like symptoms. That happens because you have constriction in your blood vessels. Arginine is metabolized by the body into nitric oxide, which is the body's natural vasodilator or ability to, make blood vessels more open to allow better blood flow. So if you have constriction, it can block off blood flow to certain parts of the brain, and that's what creates a stroke. In patients who are having imminent crisis, IV arginine should be administered. This is part of the consensus statements, and then oral arginine should be considered as daily use in patients with MELAS or stroke-like symptoms. N-acetylcysteine is a very interesting molecule. It has a couple different functions. The first function is that in the body, glutathione is the natural antioxidant. Our bodies create lots of glutathione at any given point, mostly in the liver, because a lot of this metabolic stress that happens in the liver. So when glutathione is used, you end up having non-functional glutathione. N-acetylcysteine, or NAC, helps the body regenerate glutathione into its non-oxidized state, a reduced form, making glutathione be functional again. N-acetylcysteine as well can be an antioxidant on its own. That's its other function, which is really great because if your glutathione can't be replenished quickly enough, then you can use N-acetylcysteine to scavenge those free radicals. It's very water-soluble, so it ends up getting perfused to a lot of different parts of the body. It is used in patients who have kidney damage or kidney disease. It's also used in the interesting part because of the reactive oxygen species or free radicals, Tylenol overdoses have massive amounts of free radical creation, which causes liver damage, and N-acetylcysteine is the rescue therapy for that. Glutathione would be great supplement on its own, but the problem with it is it's a very, very charged particle, which means you can't absorb it very well. If you take it orally, it gets broken down into the stomach because it's a component of three different amino acids, so it looks like a protein to the body. The body breaks it down because it's not expecting it to come in from the oral route because it creates all of its own. If you apply it topically, you'll get absorption, but it's not going to be a constant amount of absorption happening through the body through all the time. IV would be ideal, but you can't really walk around having an IV infusion 24/7, and it's extremely expensive, and there's really no guidelines or dosing for something like that. So taking an oral NAC product is, you know, less expensive, and you have the natural glutathione replenishment happening in the body as well as free radical scavenging. Excess N-acetylcysteine that isn't utilized does stick around the body as it gets filtered through the body multiple times and eventually excreted out the kidney and the urine. Higher doses are fairly well tolerated. It does really smell bad. It has a very bad rotting eggs, sulfur-heavy smell, which can make it a little bit difficult to take, especially with kids. Taking a capsule form is taking an oral supplementation or capsule is usually a little bit better of an idea, just because you get to mask a lot of that taste and you don't have to worry as much about it, but that smell is still pervasive even with a capsule. Other vitamins and redox reagents that are utilized in mito cocktails are the B vitamins, vitamin C and E, which all have antioxidant properties of their own. The consensus statement didn't really focus on any of them. They didn't have too many studies or information to reference. But the alpha-lipoic acid, which is an antioxidant in cells and mitochondria, is recommended to be offered to patients with mitochondrial disease. So it works almost hand-in-hand or in conjunction with CoQ10, but it doesn't work in any metabolic pathways on its own. Creatine is interesting molecule. It's an ingredient that compounding pharmacies were working with for many, many years, mitochondrial disease. In and of itself, it doesn't really aid energy creation. What it does is it acts as a phosphate buffer for ATP. So if the body's under stress, and basically think of a runner. When a runner's running at the very end of the race, they're very tired, they're very fatigued, they're breathing very heavily, they're not getting oxygenation very well, because that's why they're panting and breathing, trying to get as much oxygen as possible. ATP generation requires oxygen, and in a case of lack of oxygen, creatine acts as that buffer where it'll help ATP be created by sacrificing phosphocreatine into ATP. Patients with mitochondrial disease may have certain points in their disease progression where, on a daily basis, where they have this anaerobic or lack of oxygen metabolism. So the creatine can help with that buffer. A few years ago, creatine was put on a list of medications that cannot be compounded by pharmacies by the FDA, who have since reversed their decision after much review and committee meetings that we did work on along with Professional Compounding Centers of America, getting them clinical information to try and reverse the decision, which eventually, did get reversed. So we can work with it again. It just hasn't been nearly as well utilized anymore because of that temporary ban of working with it with pharmacies. So side effects of medications or of these supplements. All the vitamins can cause GI upset, and this is due to the GI tract trying to absorb all of these vitamins. It floods the GI tract with water to try and solubilize everything and then absorb it, because without it being solubilized, it won't absorb anything. The result of this is diarrhea, gas, cramping. It can lead to nausea. Taking the mito cocktails or any supplements with food or water, that will help mitigate it. Taking taking it with taking half or quarter of the doses and slowly working your way up to the full dose. High-fat meals can help increase CoQ10 absorption and it may also help with the because you're taking it with food, it'll help with the side effects of the medication. The body will adjust to this over time because it's going to expect what's happening at certain times of the day when you're dosing. So after about a week, 2 weeks or so, these side effects will kind of self-mitigate for the GI disturbances. Chronic use of certain vitamins and supplements may lead to problems. This is more relevant towards doctors and their dosing. Serum creatinine can increase when you're doing a lot of creatine supplementation because creatine breaks down into creatinine, and it looks like you might have a kidney issue because you're not filtering anything out quickly, but it's not really true. It's just because you're taking more creatine, you're having more serum creatinine buildup. Pyridoxine or B6, if you take too much of it, over 600 milligrams a day, will actually cause the neurologic manifestations that you're trying to treat, like tingling sensations, numbness of fingers, et cetera. Some of it's counterintuitive, but you know, like I said earlier, too much of a good thing can be a bad thing. So you always want to make sure you take these supplements under the direction of a doctor, especially if you're doing higher than recommended doses. As we spoke about earlier, with mitochondria having certain characteristics of bacteria that can be toxic, MitoAction has a chart on their website about these toxins. A couple of previous presentations highlighted. These aren't necessarily to be avoided, these medications. It's a cost versus benefit analysis. Do you have a situation where you need to be on one of these medications? Is that going to be more harmful to not be on it than the progression of mitochondrial disease that may get affected? For example, we had a patient who had a infection that was resistant to anything but quinolones, and quinolones are not recommended in mitochondrial disease because they can cause metabolic issues. But the infection could have been extremely harmful if the patient doesn't treat it. So their course was to go on a quinolone antibiotic. And, you know, you have to look at the cost versus benefit, and that's something that the doctor has to look at for your therapies. Expectations for the medications. None of these supplements are going to work overnight. You're not looking at a miracle cure. You're not looking at, you know, you're looking at a metabolic change in the body. You need 1 to 2 months of, you know, continuous dosing to build up the levels into the body to kind of get the body used to these levels of the nutrients. Because remember, the body's used to not having much, if any, nutrition because you're supplementing with what it needs. It's not used to functioning properly. So it has to kind of rebuild, regenerate, kind of get into a new mode of thinking or a new pathway of working. You're going to have follow-up blood work, follow-up testing just to see, are the levels where we're looking at, you know, maybe the CoQ10 levels aren't targeted to where we should be. We have to increase the dose. So just because you're supplementing doesn't necessarily mean you're supplementing the right doses right off the bat. Using a diary tool, starting before you start the supplement, while you're on it, and if you decide to stop it, then afterwards, see how you feel. You know, rate your symptoms, fatigue, mental fogginess, exercise, you know, whatever the symptomology is that you're trying to treat, that way you can kind of follow the progression. Because if you think back to how you felt a month ago, even for a normal healthy person, you're like, I don't know, was I feeling okay a month ago? I don't remember. So, you know, that is the better way of making sure to see if there's a difference in what you're taking and how you're feeling. Different formulations that are available for mitochondrial cocktails are suspensions, powders, capsules, effervescent packets, and gummies. Now, each has their own limitations. You know, capsules, you might be taking a lot of capsules a day. Powders are calibrated scoops that you mix in and take, usually are more palatable. Suspensions are usually 5 to 10 mLs twice a day, but again, depends on what you're looking at for what's going to be in the doses. The more powders you have or the higher the doses that you have, the harder it is to suspend something, and the more likely you are to work with a powder. Gummies have a limitation of only about 300 milligrams of drugs being able to be put in them. So if you're going to be taking 30 gummies a day, 40 gummies a day, it's going to be a lot harder to meet the dosing expectations. all formulations should be dosed at least twice a day, whether it's a compound, whether it's an over-the-counter supplement, however you're looking at, because you want to increase GI absorption. Four times a day is even better, but it's harder to get somebody to take medication four times a day or remember to take it. It decreases the risk of GI side effects. It helps increase absorption because the enzymes that bring in nutrition into the body and the small large intestines aren't overwhelmed. Thing to remember about where you buy your supplements. So we're talking about now supplements over the counter. You want to make sure you're buying quality supplements. Not every OTC brand is created the same, and not everywhere their supplements are being sold have the same track record. There have been in the past health food stores, bodybuilding stores, et cetera, that sell a lot of these supplements in powder formulation, but when they were tested, they had levels of arsenic, zinc, lead, et cetera, problematic things that shouldn't have been in there, especially if you're talking about somebody with mitochondrial disorder, that would affect a metabolic pathway. Using brand name supplements, Metagenix, Epifer Health, Spectrum Needs has a new supplement that they developed two years ago, Sat? Okay. So they developed that for both mitochondrial and autism patients, and they test what they do as well. That's the key thing here. So nothing that is over-the-counter that is sold as a supplement has any regulation by the FDA. It doesn't have to have any testing. It doesn't have to have any label accuracy. It doesn't have to have anything like that. So you want to use a brand that voluntarily tests to make sure that they follow good manufacturing practices on their own. No one's requiring them to do this. You can call the companies and find out which brands have what policies. So compounds in a similar situation, you want to make sure you get your supplement from or get your mitococktail from a pharmacy that has a good track record. Pharmacies should only be sourcing compounding ingredients from FDA-approved wholesalers. That does not mean that what we make is FDA-approved. You have to remember every single compound made by a compounding pharmacist or pharmacy is not FDA-approved because we're making a drug for one patient, one prescription. We're not manufacturing, so we don't have FDA manufacturing practices built in, but we do source everything from FDA-approved wholesalers, which is key. It comes with a certificate of analysis that shows exactly what's in there, whether there's certain levels of heavy metals or whether this didn't pass a certain testing or it's only 10% pure, should have been 90% pure. So when we get the certificates of analysis as a pharmacy, we look to see if it meets our guidelines and our expectations. And if it doesn't, we reject it. This is not going to be utilized. And that's the whole point of making sure that the pharmacy is sourcing something from an FDA-approved wholesaler. Pharmacies that are PCAB accredited, they have to follow these regulations where they have to check certificate analysis. They have to buy only from FDA-approved wholesalers. So right off the bat, you know that someone's PCAB accredited is doing a lot better compounding practices than somebody who's not. It's not saying that that's the case everywhere. The people who aren't PCAB accredited don't follow good compounding practices, but it's one step that you know is sure because they have to have this into their guidelines. And you can call the pharmacy and find out what are your standards, where are you sourcing this from, do you send anything out for testing? Because again, for PCAB accredited, you have to send out a certain percentage of your compounded medications to be tested. Cost. So you have to look at what your cost expectations are. A lot of over-the-counter medications, the brand names, the ones that we're talking about that do testing, are going to be more expensive than the ones that don't do testing. So how much are you paying extra? Is it worth the peace of mind for you because you know you're getting the right dose? If you're going to keep fluctuating on the dose, you're not going to be getting the dose that you're expecting, what the doctor's expecting, so your whole metabolic profile may be altered. And compounding becomes more expensive because not only do we have to purchase these raw ingredients from wholesalers and drug suppliers that have quality testing behind them, we also have the labor to make everything for each individual patient. So insurances play a role into this. We try getting insurances covered. I can only really speak for Massachusetts and the surrounding states that we've worked with mito patients. We're not licensed in every single state, so I can only speak with the states that we've worked with. most insurance, private insurance companies are not covering compounded medications, including the Mito cocktail. Prior authorizations can be done between the doctor's office and the insurance, so it's paperwork that, as a pharmacy, we help doctor's offices complete by providing ingredients of the compounded medication based on the prescription that was written. And then the doctor has to fill out clinical information, submit it to the insurance company. Insurance company then takes time to review the medication, PA, and then either approve or deny it. There's no set time frame for when all this happens. We've seen PAs be resolved within a few days, and sometimes they've taken several months before they either get approved or denied. And then, so I wrote a little bibliography of the reference sources. Additionally, there's a couple of extra slides about mitochondrial background and genetics that if you have questions about, if you want to read through them and ask as well. But I want to take this time and we can answer any questions from all the listeners. Kyra, I believe you said they can email the questions in.
Yes, that's correct. Thank you so much, Ted. That was extremely informative. So, yes, if you have questions, you can email them to info@mitoaction.org. So I've got about five questions so far. So why don't we start with those? First question is, I have a child with Mito who I struggle to get to take the supplements every day. What recommendations do you have that can help make it a little bit easier for me to get my child to take the Mito cocktail?
Okay. So I'm going to approach this as a taste issue, I'm assuming, because a lot of the supplements can be bitter. The CoQ10, riboflavin, thiamine, et cetera, they have a bitterness, a lot of the B vitamins. Mixing it in with something that is thick and creamy, yogurt, pudding, anything like that will help kind of prevent the touching of the individual supplements onto the taste buds. If they don't solubilize and go on the taste buds very well, then you're not going to get that bitter taste from there. You can also coat the mouth or tongue with chocolate syrup, honey, anything thick or viscous, molasses, anything along those lines that will help protect the taste buds from getting the medication on them. Administer the medication quickly while it's still coated, and then have your child swallow the medication, and then chase it with, again, some more of that sweet, thick vehicle, so that way it'll help kind of protect the taste buds from tasting anything. The third option is numbing the mouth with either ice or a popsicle. So crushed ice is great, so, you know, have the child, you know, suck or chew on that, leaving it on their tongue as much as possible, and that way the taste buds get numbed and there's less likely ability for them to taste the medication. And that's true for, like, all medication, not just supplementation. If it's something other than taste, if you want to do a follow-up question, I'm more than happy to try and come up with another possibility.
Perfect. Thank you. The next question is, how do you know if you should use a compounding pharmacist to fulfill your Mito cocktail supplements as opposed to just purchasing them over the counter?
So that's a great question. I can only speak with Massachusetts laws and rules. In Mass, we do require a prescription to compound. I know some states, because if it's a supplement, don't have those regulations or restrictions. You'd have to check with the pharmacies in those individual states. If it's a choice, you can talk to the pharmacy and ask them, all right, if we do this supplementation, what dose can we combine this in so that way we have the exact dosings and it minimizes the amount of supplementation or capsules or liquid or whatever that I would have to take on a daily basis. And that's really what your go-to thing. If you're going to be taking 10 capsules over the counter and 10 capsules by prescription, you're not really gaining any benefit from a volumetric standpoint. If cost is the same, again, if it's compound or supplementation, then you don't really have any benefits from that standpoint. You can choose either or. It depends on, mostly cost, volumetric decreases, compliance. If it's a taste issue for like a suspension or liquid, then those might be possibilities more for compounding if it meets those criteria. It's very unique and individual for everybody, so it's not like I can say, well, everybody should get a compound or everybody should get a supplement. It just depends on the individual needs of the person.
Now, this aside, just a comment on that. You know, also with the compounding aspects, you know, it's dose, it's very dose independent, you know, specific, meaning that, you know, if Ted, for example, needs a very specific dose of CoQ10 combined with other aspects of the cocktail, other cofactors, then, you know, that's where compounding comes in, because we can compound a specific dose that the doctor has, you know, ordered for Ted, for example. You know, the products that Ted mentioned, again, I just want to make sure that we're not endorsing any product here. We're just mentioning the ones that we've seen and worked and our patients have mentioned to us, such as Spectrum Needs and MitoQ, and the other companies that Ted mentioned. You know, they just, you know, perhaps do a little testing. These products, you know, are great if compounding is not necessary, or you know, the dose that they provide, that they have, is sufficient for the patient, then that's good. But what compounding does is it makes it very personalized. It's very dose specific to that specific patient's needs per the doctor's order. So, you know, if they've done blood levels and such, like, you know, and such, and they require a certain dose, then that's where sometimes compounding will play an important role. So that's probably an important aspect that we should consider when looking at, you know, over-the-counter stuff versus compounded products.
Great. Thank you, Saad. And so just kind of as a follow-up to that, someone just asked, could there potentially be a risk in taking 20 to 30, 40 over-the-counter capsules per day because of the extra non-medicinal ingredients, where compounding would eliminate some of those potential risks?
So from the standpoint of safety, anything, from my understanding, even though it's not FDA regulated, they're not going to put anything that's harmful to a patient and in high doses as an excipient or an inactive ingredient. Compounding doesn't necessarily eliminate all the inactives, because we do have to use some inactive ingredients to create a stable suspension or to create a capsule or anything like that. There might be less of them. For example, we might only use one filler for a capsule versus they might have like two or three fillers in a over-the-counter supplement. I don't, like I said,
I think they're talking about the volume aspect, like, you know, taking 30, 40
capsules. The volume.
You know, okay. What does it do to the GI?
So from that standpoint, I mean, yeah, if you're taking 30 to 40 capsules, especially anything I think above like 10 or 12 capsules at any given point, can form a little bit of a mass in the stomach. Because the capsules will stick together and they'll slowly dissolve over time. It won't hurt the GI tract, but you're also not going to get an absorption of the medication like you're expecting, because by the time it's time for your next dose, you still have another mass in the stomach that's still disintegrating. You're creating a second mass. It's not true for all capsules. It depends on how everything is formulated. So I can't speak to say every single time you're going to see that. This is a general rule of thumb that I kind of go by. Even if it was a compounded prescription, I would say the same thing. If we're looking at 10, 12 capsules per dose, I would recommend doing a powder formulation instead, so we don't have to worry about that overall, you know, bulk or mass forming in the stomach if it does happen. Liquid formulations also, again, don't have that problem, because you're just talking about, you know, consuming a certain volume of liquid, so we're not worried about that.
Wonderful. Okay, thank you. That's very helpful. So the next question is, do you need a prescription to start the Mito cocktail?
Like I said, in Massachusetts, yes. In other states, no.
I think it's not every state.
Okay.
A lot of compounds are, you can't do over-the-counter. Most states won't allow over-the-counter products. So
okay.
For the most part, they require a prescription.
If you're going to get it compounded, you have to have it. As far as over-the-counter supplements, no, you don't have to have a prescription to purchase them. But I also wouldn't recommend starting high doses of any of these supplements without a physician's guidance, specifically one who understands metabolic profiles and metabolic needs, because you want to tailor something to a specific dose. You're not just looking to stay heart healthy, for example. So we know the recommended dose for that would be like a CoQ10 or fish oil or whatever we're looking at, much lower than what you might need for mitochondrial disease. If you have a diagnosis, again, there's no individual guidelines. So like, I can't tell you for every MELAS patient, you're going to need this much arginine. It's generally around 5 grams twice a day, but some patients require more, some patients require less. And that's all, that's where the doctor's following of blood work and metabolic profiles, et cetera, are very critical.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so I think the important takeaway is that before starting any series of supplements, you know, you don't want to self-medicate, that you really need to have a conversation with your medical team and decide what dosages and which contents are will be beneficial for each individual patient, because it's different for every patient.
Correct.
Yep. So that piece is really important. Along those same lines, do you recommend when you're starting the Mito cocktail, not taking all of the supplements at one time, but kind of doing a build up and adding the different supplements so that you can better gauge your response and potentially side effect to any one particular supplement that's in the cocktail?
So that was a point actually brought up in the consensus statement, that they did recommend starting one supplement at a time, seeing how you do, and then dose the next one, see how you do, because dose adjustments may be necessary for each individual supplement. And it's hard to make that overall assumption. That being said, most prescribers tend to start on multiple supplements at once, not necessarily the highest or higher doses, but they start off at lower doses and work their way up, et cetera. My overall recommendation, talk with the doctor again, because you want to see right off the bat, you might know that like the doctor's had a very good experience with a patient with a similar diagnosis, that 200 milligrams of this, 300 milligrams of that, et cetera, has already formed a very good response. And then you tailor it to the individual based on, you know, blood work, lab values, et cetera. If you're overly concerned that you might have side effect issues or you just want to be a little bit more cautious, there's no problem asking the doctor, let's start with one at a time and let's go from there. That's perfectly logical and reasonable route to go with as well.
Okay, perfect. Next question is, what is recommended typically for the appropriate time to have the follow-up blood work to test your levels? How frequently should that take place?
So because we're not involved in that aspect, I really don't know. I know genetic testing is generally just done once, because genetic testing is genetic testing. Additional metabolic profiles and muscle biopsies, I don't think they do muscle biopsies more than once every 6 months or a year at the most. But blood sampling, they might do more often, like every few months or so, dependingly.
Right. The question is related not towards the diagnostics, but just to check your
right
levels out once you start the cocktail.
Right. Yeah, that's why I just wanted to make sure, because I know that they look at mutations on genetic testing as well at given points, but that was the reason why I brought that up.
Sure.
But from blood level, I mean, you're going to see an increase right off the bat, but like I said, it's not necessarily the levels in the blood you're trying to target, like we saw with ubiquinone and ubiquinol. Even though we got higher levels, it didn't necessarily make a reduction in oxidative stress. And what the testing that I'd seen in the trials that I was looking at, they did it about every month to 2 months. So I would say that's probably a fair assumption of a good time frame. But again, doctors are going to have a lot better information about that than I would.
Perfect. Thank you.
And again, you know, just going back to Ted's earlier point, is that, you know, there's no two, and what we've seen over the many years we've been doing this, that we haven't seen two mitochondrial patients the same. So, you know, maybe I need testing every month, maybe another person needs it every 2 to 3 months. So it just depends on the diagnosis and the therapies utilized to treat the patient. So
right.
It's very
perfect.
Patient specific.
Okay, that's great. The next question is, what is considered to be a high dose of the levocarnitine for an adult and CoQ10? What threshold is it considered a high dosage?
So before, we were seeing doses of levocarnitine that were up to 3,000 milligrams three times a day. I'd say the threshold for levocarnitine at this point now is about 2,000 milligrams a day max, and that's still kind of at the high end. And standard dosing is about 1,000 milligrams a day. All right. CoQ10, we're looking at about 600 to 800 milligrams being the high end of normal. we have seen patients that will go up to 1,200 milligrams of CoQ10 a day, but much more than 800, I'd say, is we're talking about the high end of the threshold, or going above that may be detrimental. But again, if blood work or the prescriber are looking at metabolic profiles and you need that more, then you need that more. But taking it on your own, it can be harmful even at like 600 or 800 milligrams, even though we know that we've seen metabolic patients with that high of a dose.
Okay, perfect. So I think that brings us to the end of an hour. It went by super, super fast.
Yep.
So I just, on behalf of everybody on the call and the community, want to thank Ted and Saad for taking the time to provide all of this great insight for us on the Mito cocktail. It's something I think that our community has a lot of questions about, and I think really the takeaway is that the importance of really making sure that you're having conversations with your medical team about what is best for you and your individual situation, because every situation is different, everyone's needs are different, everyone's reactions are different. And so it's really important to have this conversation with your medical team to make the best decision for you. I have the link available if anyone's interested in the consensus guidelines or the mitotoxicity list. If you want to send me an email at info@mitoaction.org, I can send that link to you so you have that information to share as you start to have these conversations with your medical team. So this has been really great information. As I said again, today's call is being recorded and will be available by the end of the day today on the Mito Action website. You can also learn more. I know we mentioned one of the product spectrum needs. The links to those products, although, again, Mito Action is not endorsing, but want to make sure that our community has access to what's available. And, again, having conversations and making the decisions with your medical team about what products and methods are best for you. So we will have those links available on our website as well for you to look at. Thank you again so much to Ted and Saad for taking the time today to share with us, and we look forward to hearing from everybody in the community and talking again soon.
Thank you for having us. It was a pleasure to be able to present this for you guys.
Thank you so much, everyone. Have a wonderful weekend.
Take care.